Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to this episode of Campus Firewatch Radio. My name is Ed Camo. I'm the publisher of Campus Firewatch, and we have another great show lined up for you this month. We're going to be starting off with Dan Madrakowski, who's a fire protection engineer at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who's going to talk about some of the dorm room burns that they did. They went out and they actually burned up some dorm rooms and documented them, videotaped them, and all this information is available on the web. But Dan got some really great information out of that that he's going to share with everybody. Following that, we're going to be talking to Dana Hilton, who has put together an excellent program involving Fire Corps and college students, and we met up with her at the NFPA meeting in Boston. Then Mike Halligan, who's the president of the Center for Campus Fire Safety, is going to talk about the new grant that they just received that piggybacks on the one that they had last year that puts together a training program for about 300 college fire marshals across the country. So he's going to be talking about that. And then we're going to be wrapping it up with Bob Davis, who's a reporter from USA Today, who did an outstanding article looking in depth at a whole series of fires across the country in campus-related occupancies that killed students and looked at the common factors that included building construction, alcohol, and other issues. So Bob's going to be talking about the results of that article and the study that they did. So stay tuned. You're listening to Campus Firewatch Radio. My name is Ed Camo.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Joining us on Campus Firewatch Radio is Dan Madrakowski, who's a fire protection engineer with the Building and Fire Research Lab at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Glad to be here.
Dan does a lot of fire work and burns things up and does field investigations, does some pretty exciting work down there at NIST, I must admit. I've known Dan for many years now. And asked him to join us to give us kind of a fire behavior 101, in other words, an explanation of some of the physics and chemistry and fire behavior aspects to try to fill in those that may not be well-versed on all parts of it. So I guess, you know, we'd kind of like to just start with some of the basics, Dan. You know, what is fire?
At the very basic level, fire is an exothermic reaction, which means that it gives off heat and it can give off light. It's a chemical reaction. For the fire triangle, we need the basics. We need some oxygen. We have that in our air, around 21%. We need a fuel. Many of the items in a room, the bed, carpeting, curtains, things like that, certainly fuel, clothing, plastics would be considered types of fuel. And then we need a heat source to get that chemical reaction started and then to sustain it. And once we have flaming ignition, once we have the fire burning, that fire begins to act like a pump. And basically it pulls in the fresh air and it mixes it as part of the chemical reaction, and it pumps out energy, our heat again, and light, and it also pumps out mass. And that mass takes the form of combustion products. They can be solid combustion products like soot particles, or they can be combustion gases like carbon monoxide, or depending on what's burning, you might have hydrogen cyanide or another toxic gas that's being produced. So fresh air in mixes in the burning, the fire acts as a pump, and then we have these hot gases. Well, the hot gases, because they have a lower density than the surrounding air, they're buoyant, and so they float, basically, and they'll hit the ceiling of the room. So we have a plume that's transporting these combustion products up to the ceiling of the room, and it starts to spread out across the ceiling and form a hot gas layer or a smoke layer, and will continue to fill the room as the fire is burning. If the fire continues with the appropriate balance from our fire triangle, enough ventilation and whatnot, it will continue to grow, involve more fuel. If there's more fuel available in the room to burn, the fire will continue to grow in size. The hot gas layer will continue to come down. It continues to get more energy added to it and more mass added to it. And the thing that people sometimes forget is that this smoke is also another form of fuel. So when the fire is burning initially, it's burning very inefficiently. And so the soot particles, the carbon particles, can burn. The carbon monoxide can burn again. And so when the hot gas layer gets hot enough, and again, the conditions for the fire triangle are met once again, that we have the right mixture of oxygen and fuel and heat, that hot gas layer can ignite, and the heat energy from that is so intense that it will heat up everything else in that room and cause the room to go to flashover. So
now you kind of bring up something interesting too there, because when something solid is burning, it's not actually the wood or that's the fuel itself, is it?
That's correct. We can only burn gases or vapors. So if we have a solid, we need to pyrolyze that to get the combustibles off of it to get them to burn. And if we have a liquid fuel, we have to vaporize that liquid fuel to get it to burn. Liquids and solids themselves do not burn.
Right. So when you were just talking about that room that's approaching flashover, what's happening in there? Is everything just suddenly getting really hot and really off-gassing? Is that what's happening?
Well, so we talked about the fire, and we sort of ran through the stages real quick. As that fire is producing energy, that energy has to get transferred to other fuels and other surfaces to heat them up, to pyrolyze them, to get them above their ignition temperature so that they'll ignite. So we can transfer energy in three different ways. Conduction, which is heat transfer through a solid. Convection, which is heat transfer through gases or liquids, and that can be to another gas or liquid or to a solid. So the majority of the heat transfer going on is early in the fire when the gases are moving across the ceiling and everything is by convection. And then the third is radiation, which is basically heat transfer due to light energy. And our best example of that, of course, is the sunshine every day, that the heat from the sun is being transferred to us via radiation. So what happens is that fire builds and that hot gas layer spreads throughout the room. They're convecting energy to anything that the smoke is touching, to the walls and the ceiling and whatnot, but everything under that hot gas layer is being irradiated. It's getting the radiant heat energy transferred to it. Once that hot gas layer ignites, that radiation level goes up to a point around 20 kilowatts per meter squared, which is typically hot enough to ignite almost most combustibles that we have in our homes or in a dorm room or something like that, and get those to be, so they almost start burning simultaneously all at once. So we've gone from a hot layer environment where we have a hot layer and a cool layer that's providing the fresh air to feed the fire, to now that entire room is involved in flames from the ceiling down to the floor in a very well mixed single environment, burning basically from floor to ceiling. And it will do that until it runs out of fuel or runs out of oxygen, and then it will transform into another stage. On the heat flux is one of those things that's kind of hard to gauge, but typically on a beautiful sunny day, cloudless sky, we can see about 1 kilowatt per meter squared of energy from the sun, to sort of give you a baseline. When you're operating your broiler or something in your oven, and if you get your hand too close, you don't have the oven mitt on, and you feel the heat and you pull your hand away right away, you're probably in the 3 to 5 kilowatt per meter squared range. And then of course the 20 kilowatt per meter squared range is the typical heat flux energy at the beginning of flashover, at the transition of flashover, what it needs to pyrolyze most materials and get them ignited. But when flames are actually rolling over a surface and exposing a surface, so we have a combination of convection and radiation heat transfer, the heat flux can be anywhere in the area from 60 kilowatts per meter squared up to 150 or 180 kilowatts per meter squared. So a tremendous jump in energy that's being transferred to that surface.
Now, while you're talking about energy, you always hear about a fire being a size of a megawatt, a kilowatt, or even a watt. Can you put some labels on that? For example, if I look at a cigarette, I look at a candle, I look at a trash can fire.
Certainly. A cigarette is a very low amount of energy. It's about 5 watts. A burning candle or a burning match would be on the order of 80 watts. If we were to have a small trash can fire or a small appliance fire, like maybe a coffee maker or something, where if you can visualize a flame that's about 1 foot on either side with a flame height about 2 feet tall, that would be in the area of 40 to 50 kilowatts or 40 to 50,000 watts. So usually we use kilowatts as our base item for certain fire sizes. As we move up, say, to an office chair, And if you can imagine a nicely padded office chair with flames 4 to 5 feet above it and the office chair fully involved in fire, we might be on the order of 700 kilowatts, 700 to 800 kilowatts. And then as we go to furniture like we might have in our home that's even more comfortable, contains a lot more polyurethane foam, a more combustible material, and again, imagining it with flames 6 to 8 feet above it, a very comfortable chair might be on the order of 2,000 kilowatts, and a sofa could be anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000 kilowatts. Or another way that we can refer to that is 3 to 4 megawatts. A megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts. So that sort of gives you a range. The minimum amount of energy that you need to flash over a typical residential scale room, if you will, is usually on the order of 2 to 2.5 kilowatts. So certainly the energy from a fully involved sofa is usually more than enough to cause a flashover in a residential scale room.
How about a mattress? I mean, because you get so many fires started by people smoking in bed and they start the mattress on fire. How much energy does one of those give off?
A mattress certainly could go up to 2 megawatts by itself. Mm-hmm. Typically, a mattress is usually not the only thing burning, however. There's bed clothing and pillows and other things that are very commonly involved when the mattress is burning, as well as perhaps a box spring or something like that. So it wouldn't be unusual to see anywhere from 2 to 3 megawatts worth of energy from the material that would be on a bed when it's burning and fully involved.
Let's talk about ignition a little bit here. What kind of conditions do you need for ignition to actually occur? Because, I mean, you can have a spark, but, it has to be sustained, doesn't it, to really keep things going?
Again, the key with fire is energy and energy transfer. So in order to get an ignition, it's not just the temperature. A lot of people always think, what's the flame temperature versus the ignition temperature of the material? And to give you a brief example, let's say we have a 2x4, and it's made out of wood, and it might have an ignition temperature of somewhere in the range of, let's say, 600 to 700 degrees Fahrenheit. Certainly a burning match, the flame temperature is well above that temperature. However, if we put the burning match, which has given us about 80 kilowatts, to this solid 2x4, we probably won't be able to ignite it. We'll char it, we'll may get some gases to come off of it, but as soon as the match goes out or we pull the match away, the 2x4 is not burning. And part of the reason is it's thick, it's absorbing a lot of energy, and that energy is being transferred away from the surface and keeping the surface under its ignition temperature. Now, if we have a very small splinter of that wood, so its chemical properties are the same, but what we've done is we've changed its mass, we've changed its surface-to-mass ratio, and brought it more in line with the amount of energy that the burning match would have to it. So let's say we had a toothpick or a splinter about the size of a toothpick. Now we can ignite that with the burning match. Even though we have the same ignition temperature involved as we had before, we've changed the geometry of the fuel. We've changed the surface to mass ratio of the fuel. And so now we have an ignition source that's competent or large enough to provide enough energy to start it on fire. So many things come into play. It's not only the material, but the geometry of the material, the size of the ignition source, how robust it is, the exposure time. Is it something that just lasts for a fraction of a second, or is the ignition fire sustain itself and continue to burn until it's able to get the second item up to its ignition temperature, pyrolyze enough combustible gases off of it, and get it to burn.
And when you talk about geometry too, that comes into play in regards to the location of the fuel in a room, for example, a corner versus the middle of the room, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Geometry comes into play whether you're trying to, just in the item itself, take for example a chair. It might be more difficult to start the fire in the middle of the seat of a chair, perhaps, than if the accidental ignition source rolled off into a crevice where it had fuel on both sides of it and it could retain fuel in that area. Another example, as you point out, would be if we had a trash can in the middle of a room and there were no other fuels around it, we might, get soot in the room, we'd heat the room up, but there's a good chance that we wouldn't ignite anything else on fire if it's a metal trash can. the material in the trash can would burn out. But now let's say we put it against a, in a corner or against a wall, and the wall was combustible. Certainly now we're transferring that heat to another fuel, and because of the change in air entrainment and the fact that we're maintaining more heat in that system, in that fuel system, if you will, the radiation would be going from one side of the corner to the other side of the corner and basically causing the flame to stretch, and having the air entrainment would push the flame against the fuel, and we could have quite a rapid fire development, more so in the corner than we would against a flat wall.
Now, you'd mentioned ventilation. What happens in the sort of situation where you've got a room, it's a closed, you know, it's a closed door, it's closed, windows closed, fire burns, but then it's used up all the oxygen in the room. What kind of conditions exist then?
So, basically, a fire needs to breathe, in a sense. A fire needs a certain amount of oxygen for the combustion process to continue. And basically, we still end up with an environment that's unhealthy for anybody that might be trapped inside. Because if the fire doesn't have enough air for combustion, the people inside aren't going to have enough air to breathe either. As the combustion gets less and less efficient because it's running out of air, the amount of carbon monoxide and toxic products that are being produced increases. So it's sort of a twofold effect against any human being that might be inside, because not only are they getting a higher dose of toxic gas, but they're also running out of oxygen to breathe as well. And so even though you might have a situation where the fire could smother itself and basically stop the transfer of heat and the thermal hazard, if you will, you could still have very lethal conditions inside that room.
And is that also what they call a backdraft, you know, when the doors are opened?
A backdraft is a situation where you have a fuel-rich situation. You've got a lot of the smoke, combustible smoke, and you've either got a heat source or you've got a lot of heat maintained in those hot gases, and all it's missing is the oxygen. So then if you were to vent a window or open a door, the oxygen would come in, mix with those preheated fuel gases, and again, once our conditions for the fire triangle are met, you would get a very reactive flame blowing back, under pressure, blowing back out of the doorway or out of the open window.
One of the things I mentioned in the beginning is Dan has a pretty fun job of burning things up, and some of the more interesting things he's done, I know you were telling me about the dormitories that you've burned up. Why don't you tell people a little bit about that, the dorm room burns that you've done, to learn a little bit more about this kind of scenario.
We had a old dormitory in Arkansas, and we took four rooms that were identical, and in one case we conducted the fire test. We set them up with dual occupancy, basically, two beds in each, similar furnishings, milk crates, computers, printers, Christmas lights and posters, because those are a necessity in a dorm room, carpeting, television, small stereo system, things like that. So we had all the things that you need to go to college nowadays, all the basic essentials, and we outfitted these four rooms in an identical manner with fuel. We started the fire in a trash can between the desk and the bed, and watched it grow. And in one case, we kept the door closed, and we had no sprinkler. And basically, the fire developed, and the room was tight enough. It didn't allow enough air leakage that the fire put itself out. But again, we had untenable conditions in the terms of toxic gases in the room. But the fire had snuffed itself out, and the damage was just limited to basically one corner of the bed that was next to the trash can.
How long did it take to go to untenable conditions?
This is on the order of minutes, 5 to 6 minutes type of thing. The fire didn't grow very fast, and so it took a while to get there. In another case, we left the door open, and again, no sprinklers or anything. And now we have a situation where the fire has more ventilation. It gets close to flashover conditions, but it doesn't have quite enough ventilation. It's pouring toxic gas into the hallway, down the hallway, but it's not able to pull enough fresh air from the hallway to allow it to go to flashover. So it's not until the exterior windows fail and break that we actually get our true flashover condition in the room. So again, there's a process there where in 4 to 5 minutes we have certain conditions which are untenable, and then we reach flashover at a later time based on when the windows break. We also did two cases, again with the door open and the door closed, but we had a sprinkler a fire sprinkler inside. The sprinklers activate and knock down the fire and limit the damage basically to just one corner of the bed, similar as we had in the room with the closed door. But the big difference is it keeps the temperatures down and it keeps the air clean. There's basically plenty of oxygen in the air and very little CO generated, and it maintains tenable conditions not only in the room but also, you know, in the adjacent corridor. So sprinklers do have a significant impact there with regard to reducing the fire hazard.
Did you have smoke alarms in these scenarios as well?
We did also have smoke detectors. Smoke detectors activated very early. I don't remember the exact time, but certainly the ones in the room within a minute. So they're also a very important first warning device.
And they activated before conditions went untenable then?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Dan Madrikowski, fire protection engineer with the Building and Fire Research Lab down at NIST, and there's a tremendous amount of information and data that NIST has compiled in all this stuff, more than we can certainly cover in the time that we have here. And there's going to be links to this information down below on the page you can take a look at, and the burns that you were just talking about down there at Arkansas, you videotaped those, didn't you, Dan?
Yes. And we have a CD available that you can get from NIST, which shows a comparison between the sprinklered and non-sprinklered room.
Right. And we'll have instructions on how you can get that on the webpage down below here. So, Dan, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Campus Firewatch Radio and give us a real short overview on Fire Behavior 101. And I know there's a lot more than we could possibly cover just in the short time we have here, so maybe it's not even 101. Fire Behavior 50 or something like that. But thanks a lot again for joining us, Dan.
Thank you, Ed.
You're listening to Campus Firewatch Radio. My name is Ed Kamau.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, my name is Ed Kamau, and we're here at the NFPA annual meeting in Boston, Massachusetts. And joining us today is Dana Hilton, who's a public fire and life safety educator with the Johnson County Rural Fire District out of Clarksville, Arkansas. Thanks for joining us, Dana.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I ran into Dana down at the parade conference recently down at the National Fire Academy, and she was filling me in on the Fire Corps program that they are doing in Johnson County, which uses college students. And I was very intrigued, and unfortunately, we didn't have enough time down there. There's so much going on. So I asked her if she could take a few minutes out of her day here at the NFPA meeting and kind of fill us in. So, Dana, with that, maybe just fill us in. Exactly what is the Fire Corps program, and how are you using college students as part of it?
Well, a brief overview of Fire Corps. Fire Corps is a national program in which fire departments or EMS organizations can utilize citizen advocates to help with their program. And that way, that frees up those emergency responders to concentrate more on the things that they have to concentrate on. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful program. We started our Fire Corps program in March of 2005, mm-hmm. and we did this out of a need to increase our fire safety programming. Arkansas is seventh in the nation with fire-related deaths and injuries, and we have been doing whatever we can to improve our programming.
Now, to back up just a little bit, Fire Corps is a national program, right? That's coming
correct.
Out of the U.S.
Yes.
U.S. Fire Administration? Is that who's
it's
running
it? It's under Citizen Corps,
Corps.
Citizen Corps program.
Okay. So how are you using college students as part of this program?
Well, at the 2004 NFPA conference, I had heard Wayne Powell share some information about the newly formed Fire Corps program and kind of stuck that in the back of my mind. I was intrigued by the program, but at that time didn't really feel that we had a need. But following the next year in February, we had received our third fire prevention and safety grant, and our firefighters got together and said, we have seriously got to do something. It's really hard for just five of our firefighters to do these fire safety programs. We really need some help. So that's where something clicked in the back of my mind, and I thought of Fire Corps. Went to the fire chief and to our other firefighters and asked for their permission to start a program. And unfortunately, they said yes, and then went to the University of the Ozarks, which is a small liberal arts college in Clarksville and approached their Phi Beta Lambda organization, which is a business organization. And what's neat about PBL is that one of the arms of their organization is that they serve their community in some way. So it was a really nice fit for both our fire department and for their organization. Mm-hmm. And they were very willing to take it on at that time. And since then, we've had some tremendous things happen with our fire safety programming.
Fill us in. What are some of these tremendous things you've had happening?
Well, one thing that we've had happen, which is very, very nice, is that before our fire corps program, we didn't have any volunteers or citizen advocates, so it was just the five of us. And we would have, let's say, maybe 40 fire programs a year. But thanks to our fire corps in 2006, we had 202 fire safety programs. So you talk about quite an increase.
Right.
Another benefit to the program is the decrease in residential property loss. Our district has experienced a 34% decrease in residential property loss, and we feel that this fire corps program has a lot to do with that number as well. Now, ours, okay, before when we started, hardly any volunteers, maybe 20 hours a year or something like that. Last year, in 2006, our firefighters and our fire corps members donated almost 8,600 hours towards our fire safety programming. So those things, along with knowing that we don't have to worry anymore, whereas before we would stress out, who are we going to find? Who can do this? Now we can just, we don't even have to worry about it. I can just make a phone call and say, you know, such and such, would you do this? And and I know and trust that they'll be able, that will be handled. And so that's been a tremendous benefit. Also personally, I think these students have gained a sense of purpose and have learned so much about fire safety in the fact that not only are they able to just say, for instance, do the programs on campus or do the programs in the community, they can also take it outside of the country as well. And how they're able to do this, I should have explained this just a minute ago, is that our fire corps is comprised of 100 University of the Ozarks students, and they represent 23 different countries. So not only can they do the fire safety here in the United States, they can take it to their own countries as well. So you're talking more about a worldwide impact, and we're just very, very proud and fortunate that this has worked together.
So can you give me kind of a concrete example of, you know, what are some of the activities that the students are doing? So you've got this core of great, motivated, wonderful students. What are some of the programs they're involved with?
They're involved in many programs year-round, and they're involved in training throughout the year, so they're prepared for these programs. A couple of examples would be a smoke alarm installation program. They go out with our firefighters and help install smoke alarms. They're able to conduct fire safety programming on their own. For instance, we have a program called the Reading with Sparkles program, in which our fire safety dog will go with a fire corps member to the Clarksville Primary School and assist with that particular program. The student will read a fire safety book, reemphasize those fire safety messages taught during Fire Prevention Week, go over that, and then that student, an added bonus to me as a public educator, will do an evaluation method that day, share that with me, and then I see what information needs to be reinforced a little bit more. So they do that each week at the primary school. And they also help with our annual Kids Fest Safety Fair. And one benefit with that is that they have the marketing and that promotion expertise that perhaps I know that I do not have. Right. So they help me with things that in regards to that activity that I'm not really well versed at. And because of their help, our attendance quadrupled last year. So they bring in some expertise that we really find useful. They help us also with our data analysis, another thing that I'm not well versed in. They're good with numbers, so they provide me with a different the different data that I'm our department is needing. So just so many ways that they help us out, and we're just so appreciative of their help.
So I'm another Dana Hilton out there, and I'm looking to start a program like this. What's the first step somebody should take to get something like this going?
Well, the first step is that you want to gain permission from your fire chief and your firefighters. That's really important that they have the buy-in for this program. Without their support and without their permission, you're not going to go very far. So that would be the first thing that you would do. Then you want to develop a plan. You want to know the direction that you want to take your program. And you want to know how your fire corps members will be involved. The next step would be to develop a simple job description. It can be very, very small or more complicated, should you wish, or not complicated is not a good word, but more descriptive. Mm-hmm. But just explaining what that citizen advocate will be helping you with. Then you want to assess your needs. What are the needs in your department? They may not be fire and life safety education like it is in our department. It may be something with web page development or writing grants or something along that line. So you want to find out what those needs are and then go from there. Then you want to recruit these students. And I think the best way for somebody to go about that on a campus would be to contact that particular university and get in touch with a student life office and find out what the organizations are, learn a little bit more about them, and then see if you can get their permission to approach these organizations. Mm-hmm. Once you have found an organization that is willing to help you, then you have to cultivate that relationship mm-hmm. with them It's really, truly a team effort, so you want to make sure that you're working together and you're working on the same page. You want to also try to provide training opportunities, should it be an aspect of something of your department that may be a little bit more complicated, like fire and life safety education. Provide basic training on things such as age-appropriate programming, just things that will allow them to become familiar with what you're doing in your program. And once you have this program going, I would suggest that you just say thank you often in the various ways that you right. can, because it's really, really important. You can't just bring these people in and then just not cultivate that relationship with them. You just need to show thank you by a simple thank you note or providing little events for them. College students, as you know, love food and they're motivated by food. So if you can have pizza parties, we have a pizza party out at the station, we have picnics, we do whatever we can and
to keep them fed
to
and
get
happy.
Them fed and get them happy right. because if they're happy, we're happy. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the things that I would suggest that folks can do. And it's really a lot easier than you think. It doesn't have to be something this big where you have so many people. Even if you can get just a few people on campus to help you, that can make a world of difference in the things that you're able to accomplish with your fire department.
And you can always grow it. I mean,
it can always grow.
You
can definitely can start small. Doesn't have to be massive in any way. Right. And what's nice about the Fire Corps program is you can tailor it to fit your needs. Nobody is there telling you, have to do this, you have right. to do this, or whatever. You are able to do that to fit the needs of your department and the needs of their organization as well. So it's really a great relationship, I think, between a university and a fire department or an mm-hmm. EMS organization.
Yeah. Well, we're here at the NFPA annual meeting in Boston, Massachusetts. We've been talking to Dana Hilton, who's a public fire and life safety educator for the Johnson County Rural Fire District in Clarksville, Arkansas, about her Fire Corps program and how she's been integrating that with the University of the Ozarks and the students there. And we really do appreciate it. It's an excellent program. We're going to have links on the webpage down below where people can get more information about it. And can they contact you, Dana, if they have any questions?
I would love it. Oh, okay. I would love it if they contact me. I can also put them in touch with our Fire Corps members who love to share information okay. with their peers on a Fire Corps program. So we are more than happy to help.
Right. Well, we'll put a link on the page where people can get in touch with you with your email and all that sort of thing if they have more information about it. My name is Ed Camo. This is Campus Firewatch Radio that you've been listening to live from the NFPA meeting here in Boston, Massachusetts, right here on radio at firehouse.com.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And joining us on Campus Firewatch Radio today is Mike Halligan, who's the president of the Center for Campus Fire Safety. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Hello, Ed. Thanks for inviting me to talk.
Asked Mike to come here today because the center just wound up winning a pretty significant grant from the Department of Homeland Security's Fire Prevention Grant Program to do fire safety education across the country. So, Mike, if you could just kind of fill us in on what the grant's all about.
Sure. We applied for a grant with Homeland Security to continue what we had started last year, which was to develop a training curriculum that could go out to campus fire officials and community fire officials that have campuses in their communities to reach out to students and train them more in fire prevention and fire safety. The grant we received will allow us to go out into each of the 10 FEMA regions over the course of the next year and deliver training in each of those regions to our target audience of campus fire folks and community fire folks.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about, you know, first of all, where you're going to go and how you people can sign up for it, but maybe you can fill us in on what the first part of the grant that you had last year, what you developed out of that, and how that's going to be delivered for this year. So talk
sure.
a little bit maybe more about the content.
The content, the first grant we received in 2006 was designed to create a national training curriculum for campus fire safety officers. We developed that using a team of subject matter experts that included municipal fire officials, fire safety educators, campus and government fire officials, state fire marshal's office representative, and we had student advisors and campus administrators each taking a look at the pieces of that training program. Towards the end of 2006, we delivered a pilot training session, and then again early in 2007, another pilot to fine-tune that program and get it ready to be finalized and then sent out across the country for delivery this year.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of things were developed? I mean, it's a toolbox kind of concept, isn't it?
Exactly. In there, it's a day-and-a-half long program. And over the course of that day and a half, the participants will be exposed to about 90 or so different tools that will help them deliver training to students. If they have a problem with cooking, there will be some information on cooking fire safety. If it's electrical, they'll have information about electrical fire safety, candles, all the typical things campus fire safety folks struggle with when they deal with students on a daily basis. We have materials in there to help them creatively get that message out to students. We also have information and tools on there on how to work with administration on campus. If you want to work with them to improve sprinkler coverage or retrofit sprinklers into buildings, there's information there on how to present it, how to work with the campus administrators, show them the benefits, and help them understand the importance of fire sprinklers. So you can work with administration to sell the need or sell a problem to them and get results that you're looking for as far as funding and opportunities to improve the built-in, the physical features of fire prevention and fire safety in a building.
So what format is this material in? Is it online? Is it a hard copy book? Is it on CD?
The participants will leave there with a CD that has information, as well as a hard copy book that has all of the training materials in it. So whether they're more inclined to use a book to look through information, or they want to just simply plug in a CD and take information off the CD and plug it into their university logo on their web page, on their internal documents, they'll be able to do that as well. So it's multi-formatted, either hard copy or electronic format.
Okay. So you say you're doing all 10 FEMA regions this year. Boy, that's a pretty ambitious undertaking to reach out that far. How many people are you hoping to be able to educate?
We have funding to educate about 300 campus fire safety folks. We're going to average about 30 people per class, and that will give us a nice representation across the country. And the reason why we picked 10 FEMA regions, it covers the entire country, and it allows campus fire safety folks to get to a training session that's relatively close to them at no cost. The entire training program for the participant is free of charge. We'll include, once they get there, 2 nights of lodging plus all of their meals are covered. And we felt that was important because the surveys we did indicated one of the biggest stumbling blocks to getting great training programs to students was the lack of the trainer to get to great training. So we wanted to go to them. Instead of having everybody come to one location in the country to do it, we're going to go out and be in the local areas to do that training.
Now, I know you just got the award, so have you set up a schedule on it yet? Has that been created?
It's in the works as we speak. By mid-June, if they go to the center's website, campusfire.org, they'll see a link there that indicates the cities and the dates. We'll have dates starting this August in the country, and it'll roll through early 2008 through about March of 2008 in some locations in the country. So in the next 2 weeks or so, we should have that information up on the website.
And how can you sign up for it?
A number of ways. Right there on the website, there'll be a link. They can register right there online. It'll take them through a page or two of information they need to fill out. It's a relatively simple process. They just need to go to campusfire.org, and it'll take them right through the process from there.
And what's the criteria? Because, I mean, there's 4,500 campuses in the country, so this may be a pretty popular contest. It's a pretty popular program. So what kind of person are you looking for to take part in this?
Primarily, we're looking for two types of people. First and foremost is the campus fire safety educator. If you have a job description that says provide fire safety training or fire prevention activities on a college campus in the United States, we are going to select from that pool first. Second is the pool of folks that would be community fire safety educators. They're the ones that have colleges or universities in their community and are struggling with the same issues just off campus. And so those two groups of people are the ones that we're trying to target, and we're going to try and find and have apply for these training opportunities this first go around. We anticipate this will be a multi-year project, but this first year we have funding only for about 300, and so we're going to be a bit selective in looking for those two groups of people first. And I agree with you, we will probably have many, many more applicants than we do slots available.
Okay, so for those that can't make it to the program, is there some way they can get the material?
Unfortunately, no. There's a lot of printing costs that go with it, so we are limited in our printing budget to locating or giving it out just to the program participants. Some of the information is out there. If people have a question, we always encourage them to submit questions to our website. We'll get those answered for them. Or they can call me directly, and if they've got a specific question on campus fire safety issues, we'll certainly give them information and help them solve their problems, whether or not we can get them into the seminar.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking with Mike Halligan, who's the president of the Center for Campus Fire Safety, and the center was just awarded a grant for How much was it for, Mike?
$386,000.
$386,000. It's going to provide training for about 300 campus fire officials across the country starting in August. There'll be more information, he says, on their website, www.campusfire.org, in, what, about 2 or 3 weeks, you said?
By June 15th, it'll all be up and running, yes.
Okay, great. And there'll be a link below on this page, too. If you just scroll down, we'll have a link to the Center for Campus Fire Safety as well. And starting mid-June, you can go there and start signing up for this really innovative program that'll provide you a wealth of information on campus fire safety issues. So we appreciate you taking the time to join us today, Mike.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Joining us today is Bob Davis, who's a reporter with USA Today. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Bob has written a couple of excellent stories on campus fire safety, looking at various aspects of it. And I asked him to join us today because the one that they did last August, I believe it was the one that really took a look at a lot of different components of fire safety, especially in the off-campus environment. And that was last August, wasn't it, Bob?
That's right. It was August 30th.
Yeah. Maybe you can fill us in a little bit on, first of all, how you went about doing it, because they did an excellent job of really researching this, and maybe some of your findings.
It dated back to probably a year before. We started looking at college student deaths across the country following some binge drinking deaths. We were interested in finding out what killed college students, how they might be different from others. and we compiled a database of college student deaths from 2000 to 2005 and looked at 857 student deaths from all causes. And from that, we emerged really relatively quickly a pattern with regard to fires that was interesting to us, because we found that most of the fire fatalities occurred just off campus in what I call a virtual ring around campus. So a minority of the deaths were actually on the college campus, but it was in this off-campus housing that is oftentimes very different than other housing in a town where these students were dying.
And so out of that emerged the study that you put together, which started really focusing on, I think, the two components, if I remember. One was the alcohol and the other was the building construction. Weren't you taking a look at that as well?
Yeah, we when we came back and looked at fires more closely, we started gathering property records for the structures where they died, and immediately found that age was a significant issue. That in the houses where they died, nearly 70% of the fatalities occurred in houses that were built in 1929 or earlier. So some of these homes were very old. Some four dated to the 1800s. So the actual structure they were in became kind of an obvious area of focus. Alcohol, as you say, also was a factor. We got autopsy reports on the death and looked at blood alcohol levels for those who died, and found that alcohol was very often a factor in these fatal fires.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about how the team that you put together, because I met with you before the article was published, and I was impressed with the team you pulled together to really take a look into this. Maybe you could fill in our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, the I primarily work on these investigative pieces with database editor Tony DeBarros. He and I work closely on in-depth projects, but we also pulled together a really crack team of interns, college interns for the summer semester. We had four of them come in from across the country, and they were highly motivated on this topic and proved to be a really effective workforce, because they knew parties, they knew campus life, they knew these issues you know, very well. And as young journalists, they were very eager and very effective in dealing with all the people that we had to deal with, from parents, grieving parents who had lost students, to you know, city officials who were sometimes reluctant or slow to cough up some of the records we were looking for. They were a dogged and effective team.
Now, you'd mentioned you gathered autopsy reports. What other kind of documentation did you manage to pull together to help put this story together?
Yeah, we looked at court records where they existed, where there had been some kind of lawsuit or any kind of legal action. Code enforcement reports were extremely helpful. We really learned a lot by looking at the history of the structure, and found that there were oftentimes a significant history of code violations. 13 of 43 of these places that burned had a history of code violations or were found to be in violation after the fire. And as you know, those violations can range from anything from a lack of a smoke detector to blocked exits, you know, junk and trash being accumulated, causing flammable material to be on porches or whatnot. You know, that really led us to realize that students and landlords both share a responsibility for fire safety.
Are there any of the particular incidents that really stick out in your mind that you think were probably memorable or probably indicative, perhaps, of the problem?
You know, they all tell a different story, and they're all just so heartbreaking. The one that we focused on for the cover story was one where a fellow by the name of Paul Morgan set a fire. He was just playing around. They had all been drinking, and he set a fire that ended up killing his friend Austin Cohen. And they were just best buddies, great pals, and he never meant to kill his friend. But in an intoxicated state, a real lack of judgment, was playing with fire and showing off for girls, and the fire just took off in this very old home, just off campus at the University of Dayton. And it was just, you know, these things happen so fast, and a lot of times these college students have that feeling that they're invincible and that, you know, they can kind of get away with their quick reflexes and their strength from any kind of trouble. But these fires, especially in these old structures that are not up to code, move so quickly, they really can overtake them quickly.
Now, you mentioned in this case it was the fire setter who had been drinking and had, you know, lack of good judgment as a result. Do you find that it was more a role in the person that set or start the fire or contributed to the starting of the fire, or was it the victim who was also perhaps inebriated and not able to respond to the alarm or escape, or perhaps not even respond at all?
Yeah, it's a great distinction, and one that I have to make clear that, you know, this was not a scientific study. So even though we tried to be exhaustive and use as careful measurement tools as we could, our conclusions are not scientific. And but one thing that we did find is each of those, for both the setter and the victim, alcohol was likely to be there. And it goes back to the original kind of impetus for this project, which is alcohol running through the campuses these days. There's so much alcohol, especially on the weekends, and that's when we found that these fatal fires occurred, mostly on the weekends. You know, it's so prevalent on campus that it has to be a factor. You know, we couldn't determine if you're more likely to die or more likely to set a fire if you're intoxicated, the way we looked at it. But the fact that it was so prevalent on both sides certainly led me to believe that there's some education to be done there with college students and parents and college administrators about how alcohol is linked to fires. I had never thought that fire safety would really have a link to alcohol. I thought of alcohol safety as an independent issue. When I would talk to my daughter, who's a college student, about alcohol, before I did this, I never included fire in that same topic, but certainly going to bed after having too much drink makes you less able to hear the smoke detector if it goes off, less able to respond quickly, and certainly less able to aggress to escape if you do recognize the problem.
Was it part of your research at all to look at actually how much alcohol is being consumed on campus? And
no, we really didn't look at that. It's something that others have done, and it would be a good study and something good to do. You know, and each campus, you know, many of these schools have taken action to educate their students and have different regulations and different kinds of approach with alcohol. It seems like every campus does it slightly differently. So I think that's a good area for someone to look into in the future, and we might do it ourselves. But this, we really looked at the deaths and the cause of deaths for this.
Did you find that after these tragedies that schools had taken action, or had they kind of said, well, that's just the way it goes? I mean, what was the response that you found from the schools and the communities after these fires?
Some did not learn from fires, and that was really startling to us. You know, the University of Mississippi had a fire in 1998 that burned a fraternity. It was not a fatal fire, but it was a pretty significant fire. And then that same fraternity house burned in 2004 and killed three students. And it was kind of shocking. You would have thought that, you know, having a fire in the exact same structure, that they would have put sprinklers in. You know, we found that no college student ever died in a structure that had fire sprinklers. Mm-hmm. So you'd think that they would have learned and they would have done something. But that's one case where really, you know, they made a couple of steps, but it just clearly didn't go far enough. They had just had an inspection in that fraternity, and it was not up to code, and yet they still were having this big party there. Other communities, you know, really tried to do something. D.C. came in after a fire at Georgetown and tried to enforce codes in this ring around campus. And again, that's a real challenge because, you know, it's just like any other part of the city, really. So, you know, city inspectors don't come in and knocking on doors in every neighborhood in town seeing if you have your smoke detectors up and running. But in this area right near campus, they did up their enforcement because of this fatality. And they've done the same in other places, Pennsylvania and University of Maryland. After a College Park fire, they too went into the area kind of door to door to look for the same kinds of code violations that that led to the death of a student there. So some learn and some don't, and it's real spotty. You know, it's kind of our frustration was, you know, you look at this across the country and you pull this all together and you have to ask yourself, why do you have to wait for a fatality on your campus to start taking care of this? It's clearly a risk for these students who just move off campus. They're still really adjacent to campus. It's really kind of, you know, part of the campus, really. If you drive into these areas, you know that you're really near the school, and it's a different kind of use for these properties. So it's kind of a perplexing thing, the way some cities and campuses are working real hard on it, and others are, you know, thinking it's not really a problem that's going to affect them.
When you talk to the parents, had this been something they had even thought of before the tragedy occurred?
It's interesting because so many of them told the same story, that during the exciting day of moving their student into their, you know, off-campus house, and oftentimes this is their first apartment or their first little room they're renting in a house, so this, it's a real exciting day for them. And as they're going through all those details of, you know, moving in the bed and taking care of, you know, all the little things, the shower curtain or whatever you need to take care of, so many of them told the same story in a different way, that they never thought about fire safety. They didn't look up to see if a smoke detector was there. They didn't look for egress out of the quote-unquote bedroom. So many of these students died in, you know, what they was called a bedroom, but you could really not call it a bedroom. It's oftentimes a big closet, or it's some loft over a garage, or in the case in Georgetown, a basement room where the secondary exit had been walled off with sheetrock. So it's a heady time for parents as they're moving them in, and they don't often think about it, which is unfortunate because there's some very simple safety tips that they could follow to make it a lot safer.
And that's the real tragedy, you know. We just need to get the education out there and get people more informed about these sort of things, because I have the same experience, you know, when I talk to the parents too. It's just something that wasn't on their radar and didn't, you know, they just didn't think about. That's just so tragic.
It is, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to focus on it, because it's a senseless death. I mean, these things are just always needless tragedies and very preventable.
Well, in addition to putting together a great article that was in the paper, the online component of this is excellent, because there's a lot more information there about the individual fires, and it's still up there on the website, isn't it? You can find it.
Yeah,
on the
last I
today,
saw it. It's still there, and yeah, you can click on each fire on every college campus that we found, and get more detail about what happened and the victims, the faces. I mean, that's what really hit us, is we just kept seeing these fresh, innocent faces. I mean, these folks are usually seniors; they're right on the verge of starting their new life, and to have it cut short then is just such a tragedy.
Well, we've been talking with Bob Davis, who is a reporter with USA Today and has done several articles on campus fire safety, with the latest one focusing on the role that alcohol had to play in the fire deaths. And the information is available on the USA Today website. We'll have links on it down below on the page here that you can go and read the article that Bob and his team put together last August. Just a wealth of information there. And I want to really thank you, Bob, for not only joining us, but also just putting together such a good study. I mean, I know you say it's not a scientific study, but it's probably the best I've seen out there to date, taking a look at this problem. And my hat's off to you and your team for the excellent work that you guys did.
Thanks, Ed.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Campus Firewatch Radio. Bob Davis from USA Today has been joining us, and my name is Ed Camo, and thanks for listening.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.
Thank you.